much of an answer right now.
You had a recent piece on Elon Musk's previous support for DEI policies at Tesla.
Yeah, well, look, only a few years ago, Tesla was touting itself as weaving DEI into its DNA. That's a quote out of a large report that came out from Tesla. Obviously, the politics have shifted. Donald Trump is trying to demonize DEI as a way to appeal to the working class. And the Democrats haven't made an effective argument on economics to also try to appeal to the working class. And right now, if both parties aren't really making an economic appeal, then Trump is relying on making an identity appeal.
You, in this last 20 seconds, what do you think is most important right now?
The most important thing is for the Democrats to try to gum up the works, to stop what's going on. They don't have a lot of power. And it's also important to understand that if Donald Trump is going outside of the institutions of government, then the Democrats are going to have to rely on different kinds of tactics that don't just rely on just press conferences in the U.S. Senate.
Do you think it's possible Republicans in the House and Senate will turn on Trump?
I don't believe it's going to happen. There's no historical precedent for the Republicans to bail out on their own president.
David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever. We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we will link to your articles at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County Homeless Services faces a $104 million shortfall.
Unionized nurses reach a new tentative agreement with Providence Health, potentially ending their six-week-long strike.
And in national news, Republicans in Congress race to pass a budget framework.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 21st, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland City Council isn't the only government body facing a major funding shortfall. The Multnomah County Homeless Services Department, formerly the Joint Office, says it's facing a $104 million budget shortfall starting in July. If they don't get funding from somewhere, that would mean cutting a quarter of the department's budget. It's a stark contrast from a few years ago, when the Homeless Services Department faced criticism for not spending enough of its supportive housing tax dollars. Revenue from that tax is expected to drop this year, and both Portland and Multnomah County are facing budget shortfalls that mean they'll have to scale back their contributions to the department as well. County leaders hope that the metro regional government in the state can help fill the gap. They're asking for $30 million from Metro from unspent supportive housing tax dollars and $50 million from the state. County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson said, quote, "With this grim outlook, Multnomah County cannot do this alone," end quote. 40% of the population of houseless Oregonians live in Multnomah County. Homeless Services Department Director Dan Field said, quote, "We have to acknowledge that Multnomah County is the economic and social center of our region, and it's also where the challenges of homelessness are most pronounced," end quote. It's not clear yet how Metro and the state will respond to this request. Portland is facing a $100 million budget shortfall of its own. Mayor Keith Wilson will release an early version of his proposed budget next Friday.
Unionized Providence nurses have reached a new tentative agreement with the hospital system after 43 days on the picket line. The nearly 5,000 nurses work at 8 Providence hospitals across Oregon, including Providence, Portland, and this would be the second tentative agreement they've reached. The first was overwhelmingly rejected by the nurses, who said it wasn't a fair deal. The new tentative agreement includes some retroactive pay raises, which the first agreement did not. The Oregon Nurses Association says nurses will also get a bigger wage increase than in the original agreement. Another complaint about the rejected agreement was that Providence wasn't doing enough to address nurses' concerns about staffing. Nurses say they're short-staffed and stretched thin, and they want Providence to factor how sick a patient is into how many patients they're taking on at a time. The new agreement would factor that in, the union says. The tentative agreement was reached after 3 days of intense bargaining, spurred on by a letter from Portland City councilors urging the parties to come back to the table. Unionized nurses will vote on the deal over the weekend, and if they approve it, they could be back at work next week.
Local air quality in Puget Sound in Seattle could improve thanks to new legislation proposed to limit diesel fumes from ocean-going container ships. Washington House Bill 1689 seeks to implement electric shore power and would limit engine idling as vessels load and unload cargo in Washington ports. KBOO's Dave Johnson has more on the story.
New legislation would transition more ocean-going container ships to run off electricity instead of diesel while they're docked at Washington ports. Proponents of the bill say implementing more shore power would improve air quality and cut emissions. Ships still need power when they're in port and often leave engines idling. The diesel fumes have created health problems for nearby Puget Sound residents, including increased risks of cancer and other serious health effects. Representative Julia Reed introduced the shore power bill and says both impacted communities and the shipping industry have high incentives to move away from diesel. Reed noted the transition to electric power for Washington's ports will take years to implement and will be expensive, but she adds the shipping industry is motivated by the high cost of diesel to find alternative fuels, which are already in use in Europe and in California. Georgetown and South Park, two neighborhoods in southern Seattle, as well as parts of Tacoma, face severe health disparities due to the impacts of diesel fuel and other industries. Life expectancy is up to 20 years lower in these areas compared to other parts of the state. Reed says she recognizes this has been an issue for these communities for years.
I think it's not an accident that a lot of poor, browner communities tend to be the ones that are closest to these industrial impacts. And also those communities have been speaking out for themselves.
Reed says the Coast Electrification Project will be funded in part by the Climate Commitment Act, which was upheld by Washington voters in 2024. The program uses a cap-and-trade system to help the state meet its goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 95% by 2050. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Dave Johnson.
In a display of Oregon Senate bipartisanship, a Democrat and two Republicans co-sponsored a bill to prohibit people younger than 18 from tying the knot. Under current Oregon law, persons under 18 are not permitted to vote or buy a pack of cigarettes, but they are allowed to get married. Senate Bill 548 would put a stop to these arrangements. Janine Solman, a Hillsborough Democrat, Port Orford Republican David Brock Smith, and Salem Republican Kevin Mannix are the chief sponsors of the bill. Solman says, quote, Oregon law permits 17-year-olds to get married with a parent's approval. It, however, does not allow them a way out. She went on to say, quote, even those who attempt to leave the marriage are not allowed to file divorce as a minor, and they often struggle to protect themselves, leave home, access shelters, and file protective orders, end quote. Advocates for raising Oregon's marriage age say parents can force 17-year-olds into marriage for a variety of reasons, including complying with their cultural norms or wanting to end their financial obligation to the child.
Republican senators just pushed through a $340 billion budget framework in an all-night session. It's apparently a step toward freeing up money the Trump administration says it needs for mass deportations and border security. A number of amendments were proposed, largely from Democrats trying to halt it. But Republicans used their majority to push through the package, approved largely on a party line vote, 52-48. All of the Democrats and one GOP senator, Rand Paul from Kentucky, opposed it. Senate Budget Committee Chair Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, said, quote, "What we're doing today is jump-starting a process that will allow the Republican Party to meet President Trump's immigration agenda," end quote. Graham added Trump's immigration czar, Tom Homan, told senators that the administration's deportation operations are, quote, "out of money." Being in the minority, Democrats had little ability to win the vote. They tried the tactic of forcing Republican senators into potentially embarrassing votes, including blocking tax breaks to billionaires. It, and so many others, were turned back on procedural grounds. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York said, quote, "This is going to be a long, drawn-out fight," end quote. The package is part of a broader effort to extend some $4.5 trillion in tax breaks to the uber-wealthy. House Speaker Mike Johnson is assembling a separate budget package that also seeks up to $2 trillion in reductions to health care and other programs. Trump preferred what he called one big, beautiful bill, but the Senate strategy seemed to be working on the border package first, then turning to tax cuts later.
The package allows up to $175 billion to be spent on border security, including money for mass deportation operations and building the U.S.-Mexico border wall. It does provide a $150 billion lift to the Pentagon and about $20 billion for the Coast Guard. But the process has several steps ahead. This budget resolution is simply a framework that sends instructions to the various Senate committees like Homeland Security, Armed Services, and Judiciary to further hammer out the details. Everything will eventually be assembled into another package with another major vote down the road. Republicans are insisting the whole thing will be paid for rather than piled onto debt through potential spending cuts and new revenues. In fact, one amendment that was accepted after several hours of debate was a Republican effort to fend off criticism that the package would be paid for by cutting safety net programs. The amendment from Alaska Republican Senator Dan Sullivan proposes Medicaid and Medicare be strengthened during the budget process. Senators processed almost three dozen amendments on reversing DOGE cuts, that's the Department of Government Efficiency, protecting federal workers from being fired, and ensuring U.S. support for Ukraine. Republicans are still arguing with themselves over how to proceed. The House is moving ahead with its, quote, "big beautiful bill," believing it has only one chance to get it right. Trump appears to be pitting Republicans in the House and Senate against each other to see which one delivers fastest.
Trump wants to eliminate local governance in Washington, D.C. Election denier Kash Patel is confirmed as FBI director. And federal cuts to the World Trade Center health program hurt ailing first responders. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It makes people in our community anxious. It makes our policymakers anxious, our businesses anxious. And that's just an unnecessary distraction.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says residents are on edge following President Donald Trump's assertion that the federal government should control the nation's capital. Trump says city leaders aren't doing enough to reduce crime or remove homeless encampments. House Republicans have introduced legislation to strip the mayor and city council of home rule, but it doesn't say who would run the city or how the transition would happen. The Senate has narrowly voted to confirm close Trump ally Kash Patel as the next director of the FBI. Despite his previous threats to journalists and others he says helped rig the 2020 election, he testified to senators there are already enough criminals to arrest without seeking revenge.
I have no interest, no desire, and will not, if confirmed, go backwards. There will be no politicization at the FBI. There will be no retributive actions taken by any FBI should I be confirmed as the FBI director.
A Senate committee also advanced former wrestling CEO Linda McMahon as Trump's nominee for education secretary. 83-year-old Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell says he won't run for re-election. McConnell was the longest-serving Senate Party leader and is known for ensuring a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Republican Congressman Andy Barr says he's looking at running, and popular Governor Andy Beshear would be a strong Democratic candidate. Trump is also planning to take over the historically independent U.S. Postal Service and fire members of its governing board. Members say that's illegal and plan to sue. Reductions in the federal workforce have cut 1 in 5 staff at the World Trade Center health program, and grants providing medical coverage have been frozen. 9/11 first responder advocate John Feel says police and firefighters will die as a result.
You cannot take a sledgehammer to every program. You need to take a surgical knife and with a microscope and look where the fraud is. There's no fraud in the World Trade Center health program.
Layoffs are also underway at the IRS. Democrats say the loss of thousands of workers will hurt the agency's customer service, helping Americans during tax season, and limit IRS efforts to crack down on tax cheats. So-called equal protection legislation in 6 GOP-led states would classify abortion as homicide, allowing women who have the procedure be charged with murder and subject to the death penalty. Ashley Liddo with the South Carolina-based Women's Rights and Empowerment Network has a warning for the women there.
This state is a place where if you are having a pregnancy outcome, you need to be careful about what you say and who you say it to, because some folks will come after you.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 40 degrees. Tomorrow, Edwin Land demonstrates the first instant camera, the Polaroid Land camera, to a meeting of the Optical Society of America. The quote of the day is from American Muslim minister and human rights activist Malcolm X, who was assassinated this day in 1965. He said, "I believe in the brotherhood of man, all men, but I don't believe in brotherhood with anybody who doesn't want brotherhood with me. I believe in treating people right, but I'm not going to waste my time trying to treat somebody right who doesn't know how to return the treatment."
What are you going to do? Let them roll. Let them roll just one more time.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says she got assurances from new Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that he will preserve the Indian Health Service. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says Health Secretary Robert Kennedy has pledged to preserve the Indian Health Service. She says she reached Kennedy by phone last weekend.
He was given a mandate to make a 10% reduction across the board throughout health and social services. And after we had our conversation, he committed to me that there were going to be no reductions at IHS, Indian Health Services, on his watch. It was important to have that line of communication.
Murkowski voted for Kennedy's confirmation despite her disapproval of his decades-long campaigns to undermine trust in vaccines. She defended that vote by saying she has to find a way to work with top officials in the Trump administration to represent her constituents' concerns. And she says Kennedy's IHS pledge shows her approach is already paying off. Meanwhile, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree and Senator Jeff Merkley, ranking Democratic members on subcommittees that oversee funding for the Department of the Interior, are urging the Trump administration to reinstate terminated Indian Affairs employees. They're also calling for the federal hiring freeze to be lifted and to rescind early retirement offers. In a letter sent to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum Thursday, the lawmakers asked the administration to instead work to strengthen and grow Indian Affairs staff to best meet the needs of American Indians and Alaska Natives. They say many of the Indian Affairs programs tribal communities rely on are already underfunded and understaffed, and that the administration's actions are damaging, implemented without tribal consultation, and put vital Indian Country services at risk. Wisconsin tribal nations are working toward energy autonomy. They're using renewable energy and creating economic opportunities, as Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Tribal nations have historically faced challenges to own and control their own electricity, even though a significant number of plant and utility infrastructure are in close proximity to reservation lands. Isaiah Ness founded Sunbear Industries after witnessing disproportionate opportunities in the renewable energy space.
There's not much disparity in the type of person that was receiving solar. It was one of those things that you could see the common trend very easily.
Ness now helps Indigenous and minority communities in Wisconsin to build renewable energy infrastructure with an emphasis on intersecting cultural appreciation and economic opportunities. The Menominee Nation is working to achieve energy sovereignty by 2035. Part of that vision began with their Solar Elder Project, which was created to ensure elder community members are never without power during outages. Ness says reservations typically have high power demands, and having autonomy over that is key.
It makes more sense for them to have on-reservation power-producing plants and facilities that are also sourced from clean energy, and then for them to be able to reinvest into their own community. And so this concept of a virtuous cycle is seeing how far and how many cycles can we make out of $1 that is injected into renewable energy.
Community partnerships and grants have been a crucial component to the progress Indigenous communities have made thus far. The Inflation Reduction Act allocated about $400 billion toward climate initiatives, with a large portion dedicated to renewable energy projects through tax incentives and grants for tribes. Uncertainty looms on whether programs like these will be included in proposed spending cuts under the Trump administration. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
February is Black History Month, a time to honor the legacy and achievements of African Americans, past and present. The son of a historic civil rights leader discusses how he sees the nation today and the importance of building connections in greater unity. Danielle Smith has more from Tennessee.
Legislation to provide legal immunity for pesticide companies has been introduced in state capitals across the country, and lawmakers in Boise could soon join them. Research, including from the University of Idaho, has shown a link between agricultural chemicals and cancer rates in adults and children. Head of the Idaho Organization of Resource Councils, Irene Ruiz, says pesticide manufacturers know they're selling something potentially harmful.
To throw the responsibility on a small farmer, on a pesticide sprayer, on other folks, that's just not a fair thing to do. And for them to absolve themselves from this liability is not a good thing in the long run.
A poll from September found 90% of Idahoans oppose legally shielding pesticide companies. In 2024, lawmakers introduced a bill to provide legal protection for companies that failed to warn people about health and safety issues from pesticides, but the bill died in the Senate. The sponsor of the legislation says potential lawsuits create uncertainty for farmers and ranchers. Baruez says there isn't enough warning about these chemicals and their impacts. She adds, we don't know how many people have become ill from pesticides.
I used to be a farm worker, and I know some of the ills that I have comes from pesticides. My family and friends and people that I know have long-term effects from that, and there needs to be better ways and better resources and better studies to help us understand if we are getting harmed by pesticides or how to prevent them in a better way.
Ruiz says pesticides are also an issue in rural areas, where the chemicals can drift from fields to nearby homes and schools. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The threat of wildfires is becoming more common. It can be tempting for people to stay behind even if they're told to evacuate, but that, perhaps obviously, is dangerous. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on why with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's frightening and stressful to be told that your home is in the path of a fast-moving wildfire and that you need to evacuate. Some people may be tempted to stay put, and hope that things don't get too bad, or that they'll be able to defend their house.
And I understand. I sympathize with people who are afraid of what they might lose.
But Rob Stump, the fire chief in Lyons, Colorado, says it's incredibly important to follow evacuation orders and get out quickly. As the climate warms, wildfires are growing more intense and are spreading fast, so he says there is often no time to wait and see what happens. And when people fail to evacuate, they risk their lives and the lives of others.
If I got to send two firefighter EMTs off to try and get someone who'd been warned time and again to get out and hadn't, that's two firefighters that I can't put on an engine doing structure protection to keep the neighboring home from burning down or put on the fire lines. It absolutely takes away from what we're trying to do. I know it's a painful decision to make, but the best course of action is if and when somebody with the training and the expertise tells you that you shouldn't be there, you should listen to them and you should evacuate.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And now, February is Black History Month, a time to honor the legacy and achievements of African Americans, past and present. The son of a historic civil rights leader discusses how he sees the nation today and the importance of building connections and greater unity. Danielle Smith has more.
In Tennessee and nationwide, communities are celebrating Black History Month, recognizing the contributions and achievements of African Americans to American history. Historian Carter G. Woodson launched what was initially Negro History Week in 1926 to honor the works of Black educators, inventors, lawyers, entrepreneurs, and artists. Among those carrying forward this legacy is Martin Luther King III, a human rights activist and the only surviving son of the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He says he remains committed to advancing his father's vision of equity, justice, and creating legacy daily.
It's about building something every day, hopefully something that can make a difference in our community, in our society, in our cities, and also in our world. It doesn't have to be massive that way. It can just be something small, but it's what you do to sort of make a contribution in life.
The U.S. Civil Rights Trail includes 14 locations in Tennessee, according to the state's tourism office. Beyond Black History Month, King emphasizes the need to restore civility in today's political climate. He stresses the importance of rebuilding dignity, respect, and inclusivity, ensuring that all people are treated as human beings. The national response to President Donald Trump's executive orders dismantling diversity programs has been mixed, and King acknowledges the country's deep divisions. He believes his father would encourage more dialogue to foster understanding and achieve unity. He notes the country calls itself the United States of America, but lately is seeing too much hostility and even hatred.
Rights are being lost. Some are banning books. We still don't have the full rights to vote without some encumbrances. We still don't, all of us, have health care. We certainly still don't have a system of justice that works for everyone.
King highlights his Realize a Dream initiative, encouraging Tennesseans and people nationwide to complete 100 volunteer service hours in honor of his father's 100th birthday in 2029. He notes the initiative is inspired by Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1967 book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? I'm Danielle Smith, Tennessee News Service.
A Nevada researcher has developed a game-changing grain that is more resilient as the western United States becomes hotter and more arid. As Alex Gonzalez reports, the researcher believes her unique varieties can be of great value to dairy farmers.
One researcher at the University of Nevada, Reno, has developed what she calls revolutionary sorghum varieties for dairy cow feed and gluten-free human foods. Associate Professor of Agriculture Melinda Yurka says the western U.S. is facing accelerated rates of climate change and drought, highlighting the need for resilient alternatives. She adds the traditional crops grown in Nevada, like alfalfa to feed beef cows and corn for dairy cows, are struggling to keep up. The sorghum varieties Yurka and her team have developed now may allow farmers in the region and globally to be better prepared in the face of a hotter and drier climate.
Sorghum is a very good alternative grain crop for various uses. Primarily, it's used as an animal feed in the United States, but it also is an alternative crop to replace corn, for example, in dairy silages.
Yurka explains that dairy silage is fermented feed that's curated to feed dairy cows that in turn provides them with the required energy and nutrition to produce milk. Yurka says the over 200 varieties she and her team have developed not only use significantly less water, but they're cheaper and produce higher yields too. Yurka says field studies have confirmed that her seeds perform best on 20 to 25 inches of water per year. That's significantly less than the 30 to 40 inches that corn and alfalfa require. She adds she's received significant correspondence from farmers around the nation that have expressed interest in her varieties. That eventually led her to found Yurka Seeds in 2023 in an effort to fulfill the development and commercialization of her sorghum varieties.
This is putting me in a situation where I need to scale up my business very rapidly to meet demand, and that's posing like a special challenge. It's a good challenge, but it's a big challenge right now.
Yurka would like to license her high-performing sorghum varieties to then offer them to companies that are capable of producing commercial quantities. Later this year, Yurka will be organizing an event where bakers, mills, breweries, chefs, and farmers can learn more about her different varieties. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
A 79-year-old man from Beaverton is $140 million richer after winning the Powerball jackpot. Abbas Shafi bought his winning lottery ticket on January 17th at the Beaverton Fred Meyer on Southwest Walker Road. The total jackpot was worth over $300 million, but Shafi decided to take the lump sum payment. A lump sum payment means he'll get a lesser percentage of his total winning, but he'll have it right away. The other option is to take an annual payment, which means a larger total amount of money over the years. Shafi said this statement, quote, "I am overjoyed to have won the Powerball and plan to use my prize to travel, invest, and share my good fortune with the nonprofit organizations that are close to my heart," end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 21st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us.